This is the World Vision Report. I'm Beverly Abel, in for Peggy Wehmeyer. Join us today for stories of the world's most vulnerable people and those who make a difference in their lives. On this week's program, we meet some kids who are breaking through age-old barriers.
My name is Ari.
I am is Yossi.
My name is Elon.
They're students at a school in Israel where Jewish and Muslim children are taught side by side. And a Hollywood photographer shifts his focus from the rich and famous to migrant farm workers. Plus, leveling the playing field for the disabled in Ghana.
You feel fit, and then you feel confident about it, and then you have your self-esteem developing so much because you feel good about yourself. So you are empowered.
Welcome to the World Vision Report. Neve Shalom is the name of a small community in Israel between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. The name means oasis of peace, and with good reason. For several decades now, families there have been raising their Jewish and Muslim children side by side. In the 1980s, they opened the first combined Jewish-Palestinian school in Israel. On a recent trip there, reporter Shia Levitt visited the school, and she sent us this report.
A rowdy group of sixth graders is working on an assignment. They're making clay replicas of ancient oil lamps, artifacts they studied in a recent archaeology lesson. As they mold the clay, the kids talk to each other and the teachers in both Hebrew and Arabic. When it opened in the 1980s, Neve Shalom School was the first bilingual Jewish-Arab school in the country. Now, more than 150 students attend. About half are Jewish and half are Arab. Each class is taught by one Jewish and one Arab teacher. Many parents in the region forego their local schools and bus their kids up to a half hour each way, just so they can attend integrated classes. Teacher Eddie Edlund co-founded the school. She says the goal was to establish an educational system that valued both religions and traditions. Still, she says, the school has to confront real-world problems, especially when violence erupts in the region.
When there is tension in the country, there is tension between the parents from the village who are very aware of politics and are frustrated about the situation outside. Some people, I think, that they really would like that it will be more political school and what it is. I have a conception that it is a school, first of all.
Palestinian Laila Najjar was one of the first to graduate from the school back in the 1990s. As she walks around the playground, Najjar recalls her classes here.
When we learn history, we didn't learn just my history. We, of course, learned the other side history, what's happened, the wars, the conflict.
When we drop in on the sixth grade class, the kids talk to us in English.
My name is Ari.
I am is Yossi.
My name is Elon.
Najjar also speaks fluent Hebrew, but the school's cross-cultural mission goes beyond language. Najjar says she was encouraged to express herself even on sensitive subjects.
They teach me how to deal with some of the things that most of the people are afraid to deal with it, if it's by talking or playing with the other side, or trying to have a conversation about not just the normal things, also about politics, about everything, to say a lot of things I'm afraid to say outside.
After graduation, Najjar went to a segregated high school. Many of her classmates were shocked to hear she had Jewish friends from childhood. For Najjar's 16th birthday, she invited her Arab high school classmates to her home, where they met some of her Jewish elementary school friends.
I think that it was the first time that my friends in the class, that they have the ability to talk or to start to talk or to know about the other side. It was a beginning.
Ori Sonnenschein is a former classmate of Najjar's. He's Jewish, and he also attended a segregated high school. Sonnenschein noticed that many of his peers had been sheltered from the experiences he took for granted.
Most of them never met an Arab, never spoke to an Arab, never didn't learn Arabic. So everything they knew about Arabs was either from the news or from what they learned in school or from their parents. And none of it was actually substantiated with what they saw with their eyes. So it felt like they were, at least in that sense, they were not ignorant, but they were lacking. They didn't have enough knowledge.
Back at the school, there's time for a quick game of dodgeball after class. Kids are laughing and yelling out to each other in Hebrew and Arabic. Sonnenschein believes if more people had experiences like this, it could impact the conflict between Jews and Arabs.
Even if it doesn't bring a peace treaty between the two sides, at least between the people, it would be easier to communicate and people will understand each other better. If there's, at least in some basic level, they meet with them, they hear what they have to say.
Neve Shalom School was unique when it began, but other educators have followed suit. There are now 4 other integrated bilingual schools in Israel. For the World Vision Report, I'm Shaya Levitt in Neve Shalom, Israel.
California is the home of Hollywood and star-studded sidewalks, but the Golden State is also home to the decidedly unglamorous world of agriculture. California produces half the fruit and vegetables grown in the U.S., and around 1 million farm workers bring that food from the fields to our tables. It's rare that these two worlds collide, but they did in the person of Rick Namias. He's a former screenwriter and photographer who decided to document the lives of migrant workers. The result? A book and exhibit called The Migrant Project. He spoke with the World Vision Report's Peggy Wehmeyer about his work.
I wanted to start by asking you, why did you decide to start taking photographs of migrant farm workers? What inspired you?
Well, it was kind of like the perfect storm. There were a bunch of things happening in the U.S. and in my personal life, which kind of culminated. I had, as all of us here, I think, been very personally moved by things that happened around 9/11. My response to that was to nest. And when I nest, I cook. So I got very involved with food. And one of the things I did is spent a week up at the Culinary Institute in Napa Valley. And I found that where we are incredibly privileged by the amount of food and the quality of food we have here in the country, we are unfortunately very ignorant, and I included myself in this category of people who just don't ask questions about where that food's coming from on a human level.
So, Rick, how did you get started? I understand you had your old Nikon camera. You took black and white film, not digital, and you just
no digital.
Quit your job and went out into the fields?
You know, more or less. I spent about 8 weeks steeped in research, trying to build a mini network of people that I knew would aid in getting into what is a very closed-off community. It may be a million plus, but, you know, clearly I'm a white middle-class male. I'm walking into a field with a camera. And, you know, it's one of those things where how do you make inroads to get the photographs you need and the connections you need? But after about 8 weeks of that, I definitely went into the fields with a camera and, you know, began shooting, not knowing really what I'd find.
And you had to get into their lifestyle somewhat to get a real feel for their work. You were working in 100-degree temperatures. Didn't you meet them like at 4 o'clock in the morning when they were just beginning their work days?
I did. And I mean, there's no question. What I did was a scratch on the surface as far as the endurance it takes. So by no means do I want to portray that I was out there doing anything close to the work that these people do 6 and 7 days a week for decades at a time. I had the luxury of going back to an air-conditioned hotel room. It might have been, you know, Motel 6. But it wasn't a lean-to on the side of a building. I mean, the side of a hillside. It wasn't an underpass where my belongings were spread for 2 or 3 months. But the truth is you can't take these images without being there at 2 in the morning, 4 in the morning, and being out in that heat. And what's crazy is that, you know, I do consider myself someone who has a decent physical endurance. But even with that, and even having limited exposure, you could spend a day out in the middle of the Coachella Valley in May, and it would be 100, 110 in the grape vineyards, and I'd be finished in 3 hours. I mean, I just would be, you know, get me out of here and realize these people had another 6 hours to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's look at some of the photographs. Here's a picture of 2 really cute little boys standing in front of a clothesline, which is really right up against, is this a grape field?
Yeah, it's a table grape vineyard.
Okay, so you've got the 2 little boys. I'm assuming they live there. There's some like scrap tin, and then you've got a clothesline, and there's the vineyard like within feet of it. Why did you take this picture?
I was literally smuggled into this migrant camp, which is in the middle. It's basically a couple of cinder block buildings that they call home in the middle of a vast fields of grapes. And I was smuggled in because had they known I was coming, there would have been a lot of upset amongst the growers or the contractors. So basically, I was kind of there under the radar to be shown how certain families are not only kind of living in almost an indentured servitude, but the conditions in which they're forced to live. And in these cases, you've got two little boys who, more or less, that's their playground. The crazy paradox is that this is within 3 to 6 feet from an active vineyard, which is sprayed indiscriminately and without warning with pesticides on a regular basis.
Are there any statistics to show that the pesticides have taken a toll on the migrant workers' health?
Yeah. There's really crazy spikes in things like leukemia and stomach cancer for people who are living on the, right against the fields.
There's another picture. Just the whole portrait is of a woman's head, but it's almost completely covered. She has a baseball cap on. You can just see the top of her eyes. And it's not like a veil that a Muslim would wear, but it's a scarf going right under her eyes, covering the whole bottom half of her face. And you say this is a traditional attire for female field workers.
I see it and saw it over and over again. And basically what I've learned from that is two things, that it clearly is sun protection that women wear that men don't. But I think more importantly, what really piqued my interest in it was that it is a way for women who are underage to not be detected and not be asked about their age. But you can be 13 or 14 years old and dress like that and very easily pass for a 20-year-old.
Is this a way that they hide the fact that they're using child laborers to do this work?
Yes, absolutely. And I think the stats come out that there's, I'm going to go up on my stats if I offer it exactly, but there's hundreds of thousands of children in the fields.
Not everything in your book is dark. There's a lovely picture I'm looking at right now of young children almost dancing and celebrating in some kind of a pageant with masks on.
There's no question that this project could have had another 20 or 30 images just about children. They're so important in so many ways because they are why the parents are out there doing this work. If you ask any migrant why they're doing this, the first thing is to support their kids. This image was migrant children, which means they basically are traveling with their parents several months of the year, which means they move every 2 or 3 months to a different school, which puts them on a whole different schedule. It means that their dropout rate is much higher. It means that there is much less support for them because often they're not speaking English or even Spanish. They're often speaking, indigenous dialects coming from Central America and parts of Mexico. This particular image was, I think, an upbeat shot in the sense that I was invited to a pageant celebrating a teacher exchange, which included teachers from Oaxaca coming to America and American migrant teachers going to Oaxaca for a several-week exchange program. And this pageant was to celebrate the culmination of that exchange on a successful level. I mean, there are definitely things being done and some positive notes that are being hit, but it's on such a minute level and it's being so overshadowed by the exploitation that continues.
I understand that some of the migrant workers actually came to an exhibit and saw the photographs. And what kind of response did they have when they saw the pictures of the work they do?
The first time these images were displayed as a work in progress was at a little library in Hollywood. And I invited everybody I know. It was my first one-man show, and I just wanted to make sure that there were people there. But I also wanted to let people know that for the months that I had been out there and the people I had met, that I didn't just disappear with this work, that it actually was culminating. And several people from the fields drove 3 and 4 hours to get there from down in Calexico up in Salinas. And there were several people who, when I looked over, were crying. And I asked someone to translate, ask them why they were crying, and they translated it for me, basically, that they had never seen an image of themselves framed and presented with dignity or respect. It was a moment where I really said I needed to do more work with this. I needed to really find a way to help bring these pictures out to more people. It's a long mission, and it's something that I believe I will be attached to for a very long time to come. I did not expect that 5 or 6 years after taking these photographs that I would continue to be deeply involved in this work.
Okay, Rick Namayas, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Rick Namayas is a photographer based in Los Angeles. His exhibit, The Migrant Project, will be in Michigan and Alabama this fall. To see some of his photographs, go to our website, worldvisionreport.org. Immigrants often leave the place they were born with dreams of making a better life for themselves and for their families. But it doesn't always work out as well as they had hoped. Last month, groups of South Africans attacked poor immigrants from other African countries. The locals blamed the migrants for taking away jobs and housing and for perpetuating the very high crime rate in that country. At least 65 immigrants, most from Zimbabwe and Mozambique, were killed in the violence. Hundreds more were injured. Small businesses were looted and shacks were burnt to the ground. As many as 80,000 immigrants fled their homes. Reporter Gretchen Wilson was in Johannesburg at the time, and she sent us this reporter's notebook.
When the attack started, I got a call from my Zimbabwean friend, Sam. She lives a few miles away from me, south of Johannesburg's city center. She was sobbing so hard, she couldn't catch her breath. I could barely understand her. I made out the words dead and uncle. She said her brother and uncle had both been downtown and were surrounded by a large group of men armed with sticks, knives, and guns. Her uncle was killed. Her brother barely got away. And then a family friend called her. He had locked himself inside of his house. He told her that a crowd was outside, banging on his door. He said he expected to die too. Sam was terrified. I didn't know what to do. I felt so powerless and depressed. But over the next few days, I found my mood shifting unexpectedly from anguish to a kind of hope. I visited a police station in Alexandra, a township north of Johannesburg. This is where immigrants fled when crowds started bashing in the doors of their flimsy shacks and corner shops. On this morning, the police station looked like a refugee camp. White tents crowded the parking lot. In the rain, hundreds of men stood in lines to get bread and tea. I interviewed many of them, and they all had this in common. They're poor, black, and they've come to this country in search of a better life. This wave of violence has created countless tragedies, yet as I looked around, I saw something I hadn't expected. South Africans had come to help their neighbors who'd been attacked. One woman held a clipboard, while others handed out donated food, clothes, and blankets. Local leaders were working with police to find a warmer building for the hundreds who'd fled here. In an upstairs room, volunteers played games with dozens of women and children. And here in this room, it becomes so clear that the violence that's affected so many people was carried out by such a small group of perpetrators. Ordinary church halls are in the nerve centers of relief operations. School groups host public forums calling for tolerance, and neighbors reach out to neighbors. A week after my friend's uncle was killed, thousands of South Africans joined immigrants in Johannesburg for a march against xenophobia. The group was as diverse as this country, black and white, rich and poor, families with children and elderly pensioners. Many carried colorful signs and balloons through neighborhoods that are home to the city's biggest migrant communities. Onlookers cheered and waved from the sidewalks and the windows of apartment buildings. The crowd clapped hands and danced in the streets singing, "We must struggle, struggle against injustice." And my friend Sam? She says knowing others are there to support her makes her feel strong. She no longer feels alone.
Gretchen Wilson is an American journalist living in Johannesburg. In the West African country of Ghana, people with disabilities are shunned. Many are rejected by their families, and they often struggle to find work. It's a life that can seem hopeless. But for some people with disabilities in Ghana, there's one place where there is a level playing field. Emily Bowers reports from Accra.
This is the sound of wheelchair basketball. On an outdoor court in the heart of the busy downtown market, Accra's wheelchair basketball team is having its weekly practice. Worn-out, rickety wheelchairs, all cast-off donations, race over the cracked surface as the players lob shaky passes between each other. Other players huddle in the shade of a parked truck on the sidelines, waiting their turn on the court. The players are covered in sweat as they stop to listen as a coach passes on some tips.
The one holding the ball is the most dangerous, so keep on watching them.
This team is co-ed, and 26-year-old Fatih Rumoro is one of five women playing today.
It's like, it makes me feel great. And when I'm in the field like this, I don't feel like I'm a disabled. If I see myself as able person, yeah.
In Ghanaian society, people with disabilities are often rejected by their family and friends. Most end up living in extreme poverty. Disabled beggars are a common sight in Ghana. Fatih lost the use of her legs when she contracted polio as a baby. While she lives with her parents, she had to drop out of school because of money, so basketball is everything. She says when people see the team in action, they're shocked.
Somebody who have never seen such a thing before. If the person see you, see the person open his mouth.
The basketball team is organized by the Ghana Society for the Physically Disabled. It's an advocacy group that gets both private and government funding. It all started in 1994 when an American aid group brought wheelchairs to Ghana and taught players basics of the sport. The team has now grown to a nationwide league with about a dozen volunteer coaches. 29-year-old Abdul Aziz Mohammed heads up the national basketball program. He's also a polio survivor and plays in a team in his hometown of Kumasi, Ghana's second biggest city. As a child, Abdul played soccer with his friends, despite the fact that he had no wheelchair and couldn't use his legs. He played by getting around on his fists.
And while I was crawling, I think I was seeing all my mates doing sports and I had to take parts. So they were playing with their legs and I would also play with my fists.
Abdul says his success in the basketball court carries into his daily life.
You feel fit. And then you feel confident about it. And then you have your self-esteem developing so much because you feel good about yourself. So you are empowered.
Wheelchair basketball teams are now in each of Ghana's 10 regional capitals. The Disability Society also sponsors track and field sports, table tennis, and soccer teams for disabled athletes. For the World Vision Report, I'm Emily Bowers in Accra, Ghana.
In Kabul, Afghanistan, it's not basketball that's changing the lives of disabled people. It's bicycles, Will Everett reports.
It can take well over an hour to drive from one end of Kabul to another. So getting documents from one office to another can be difficult for the embassies, government offices, and the many international organizations that work here. One group has found a solution. They call themselves the Disabled Cycle Messenger Service. Mohammed Amir hops awkwardly on one leg as he tries to mount a 10-speed bike. He's just gotten a job to take a document from the United Nations office to an office several miles away. Both of his legs were blown up in a landmine explosion, but he only owns one prosthetic limb loaned to him by a friend. His bike has been specially modified to be pedaled with just one leg. The stump of his other leg rests on a post welded to the frame to provide balance. As he races down the street with an empty document bag slung over one arm, you'd never guess that he was an amputee. The 15 members of the Disabled Messenger Service come to their mud brick office nearly every day hoping there'll be work.
Trying to make deliveries by bicycle is not easy for us. I've got a permanent callus on my palms.
The callus on Hali Yobar Hismant's hand is a half inch thick. It's caused by constantly clutching stairway banisters and gripping handlebars. Hismant is one of the founding members of the Messenger Service. He lost a leg when he stepped on a landmine a decade ago. He tried to find ways to support his family of 10, but job opportunities for amputees are virtually non-existent in Afghanistan. Then, about 5 years ago, he bought a bicycle and paid to have it modified so he could do odd jobs for friends and neighbors. The idea caught hold with several friends who were also amputees. Most had lost limbs to landmine explosions during the Soviet occupation or during the reign of the Taliban. Together, they founded the delivery service.
If I didn't work here, I couldn't provide for my family, and they would die or become beggars. There are so many charitable organizations in Afghanistan, but none would help us. So we decided to help ourselves.
Eventually, the government did help them a bit, giving them the use of this simple building as an office.
This is for sleeping house.
It consists of two small rooms and a kitchen. They can't afford a power generator or indoor plumbing. Each night, two of them sleep here to guard against burglars. There doesn't seem to be much anyone would want to steal, just a few carpets and cushions and some crutches. But in the courtyard, Hismont revs up one of the two motorcycles they keep for long-distance deliveries.
We bought these motorcycles with our own money. If we had more motorcycles instead of bicycles, we could work faster and more efficiently. It would help our business a lot.
Afghanistan is a country with an estimated 600,000 landmine victims and few government programs to assist them. Most become beggars, a fate the disabled messengers hope to avoid through their own hard work and ingenuity. A middle-aged amputee named Koher is one of the newest members of the organization.
None of us has been a beggar. We won't do it. We want to make money with our own labor. We'll never turn into beggars.
Hale Yobar Hismont says the messengers don't need charity, but more business.
Many disabled people are hearing about us, and they want to join our organization, but we can't accommodate them yet. We tell them, just wait. We put them on a waiting list for when our organization grows.
But that may take a while. Competing messenger services are sprouting up in Kabul all the time. So sometimes the phone doesn't ring for hours. During those slow times, they take flyers around to embassies and hotels, letting them know that the disabled cycle messenger service is open for business. For the World Vision Report, I'm Will Everett in Kabul, Afghanistan.
And that brings us to the end of our show today. Remember, you can hear us on the web and check out some great photographs that our reporters have sent us. It's all at worldvisionreport.org. You can also sign up for a podcast there if you want to take us with you. Our radio team includes Doug Boyles, Mark Bandy, Lida Hartman, Diane Toomey, and I'm Beverly Abel, in this week for Peggy Wehmeyer. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.